So, Your Excellencies, distinguished members of the audience, ladies and gentlemen, it gives me great pleasure to chair the first panel at this inaugural Southeast Asia Forum, which will focus on regional security and the role of ASEAN. My name is Jürgen Hake. I'm based in the International Relations Department here at the LSE, and I'm also an associate at the Saw Swee Hock Southeast Asia Center. Before I introduce the three speakers on the panel, allow me to say just a few words. ASEAN's establishment in 1967, of course, owes a lot to security concerns which were experienced at the time by its founding members. Notably, though, up to the early 1990s, ASEAN did not formally engage in security cooperation, even though members agreed, for instance, to form a zone of peace, freedom, and neutrality, ZOPFAN, in the early 1970s, or lay down principles in the Treaty of Amity and Cooperation that were designed to promote regional stability and security. So it's only really since the early post-Cold War period that ASEAN countries have formally defined and to some extent redefined the role that the association would play in maintaining regional stability and security. In 1994, ASEAN members extended their particular mode of preventive diplomacy and confidence building to the ASEAN Regional Forum, which remains to this day the most inclusive forum in which foreign ministers can address security issues. Under Indonesia's leadership, and of course with the personal input of Pak Rizal Sukma, ASEAN countries agreed in 2003 to work towards a security community, later termed the political security community, as one of the three pillars of the ASEAN community. This was perhaps prompted in part also by the growing number of non-traditional security issues that Southeast Asia was facing at that moment in time. The realization of the ASEAN community was, of course, celebrated at the end of 2015. That said, academic observers of ASEAN in particular have never really stopped asking the question how we should think about ASEAN as an actor in the management of regional security and order. Let me restate perhaps four of these questions, and this follows obviously from the earlier session. To what extent can and does ASEAN play a significant or leading role in addressing regional security issues? In what ways, if any, have ASEAN members over the years allowed the association to go beyond the roles the grouping had assumed by the early post-Cold War period? In other words, what is the practice of ASEAN security cooperation really about? Thirdly, to what extent can ASEAN successfully deal with China's so-called new assertiveness? And fourthly, and this again follows up very clearly from the last session, is ASEAN's centrality, unity, and coherence under threat? To help us address these kinds of questions, I'm joined here on the panel by three very distinguished speakers. First of all, Professor Jörn Dosch. Professor Dosch is based at the University of Rostock, where he's the Chair of International Politics and Development. Before joining his current employer, Professor Dosch was Professor of International Relations and the Acting Head of the Social Sciences at Monash University's Sunway campus in Malaysia, as well as Professor at the Department of East Asian Studies at the University of Leeds. As one of Europe's leading scholars in Southeast Asia, Professor Dosch has a very substantial and distinguished publications record. He may be best known for his works on regional cooperation and integration, and his latest book, out only last month, focuses on the ASEAN economic community. He has obviously also written on various aspects related to political change in Southeast Asian countries and development cooperation between Europe and Southeast Asia. Professor Dosch is also currently a visiting professor at the Saw Swee Hock Southeast Asia Center. Professor Dosch will talk about the record of the ASEAN political security community, and the title, as you can see on the program, is The ASEAN Political Security Community, Just a Sideshow? Then we will have, secondly, Bill Hayton, who works not only as an associate fellow at Chatham House with responsibility for the Asia program, but also for BBC World News Television. In 2013 or so, he spent a year in Myanmar giving advice on media reform. A few years before that, Bill reported for the BBC from Vietnam, which allowed him to write a book on the Rising Dragon. Bill Hayton is arguably even more famous, however, for his subsequent book on the South China Sea, which was one of the Economist's Book of the Year in 2014. It is indeed a great book, and I would like to recommend it to you all if you have not read it yet. As there are so many fascinating angles to the issue, I have asked Bill to talk about the South China Sea once more today. His presentation this morning is entitled ASEAN and the South China Sea, Only Good on Paper? And finally, we have Dr. Thitinan Pongsudhirak, who is the director of the Institute of Security and International Studies and also associate professor of international political economy at the Faculty of Political Science at Chulalongkorn University in Bangkok. Khun Thitinan has written extensively on Thailand's politics, political economy, and foreign policy, as well as on ASEAN and East Asian geopolitics and geoeconomics. His op-eds have regularly appeared in international and local media, and he has his own column, I believe, in the Bangkok Post and the Straits Times. Anyone who knows this work knows that Khun Thitinan is one of the smartest analysts and commentators, not only in Thailand, but the region. I would like to mention also that Dr. Thitinan, too, received his PhD from the London School of Economics, where his work on the political economy on the 1997 Thai economic crisis was awarded a prize for the best dissertation in comparative and international politics. Khun Thitinan will focus today on the issue of ASEAN unity and coherence. His talk is entitled Together and Apart, Where ASEAN Meets Southeast Asia. I'm delighted to have you all with us here, and speakers have 15 minutes each, and we will begin with Yuan Dosh. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Excellencies, ladies and gentlemen, good morning. First of all, three thank yous. First to Jürgen for the very kind introduction. Of course, he exaggerated. Second, of course, to Professor Danny Kuo and Professor Saw and the wonderful dedicated team at the Southeast Asia Center, Zoe, Lee, and Jenny, who have been working very, very hard for the smooth organization and the preparation of this conference. I know that because we are sharing the same workspace. So I have seen them there almost every day. I mean, they have been there every day. I wasn't there every day. That's the point. Working very hard on making this conference possible. It's, of course, a great pleasure to be here. And so I'm very thankful for the opportunity of sharing some of my views with you today. The third thank you is to someone who is not here today. I would like to mention that, although you probably don't know him, my PhD supervisor, Manfred Molz, one of the leading experts on regional integration and process of regionalism in Germany, one of the pioneers really also in the study of ASEAN in Germany, who was very influential in the 90s and also throughout the 2000s in contributing to the debate. He passed away last week, I would really like to take this opportunity in a way also to dedicate this presentation to him, because he introduced me to ASEAN almost three decades ago, and so I wouldn't be here if it wasn't for his fascinating work on ASEAN that really also excited me a lot, and so this is the reason why I've been working on ASEAN for more than 25 years now. The ASEAN political security community, just a sideshow, two apologies now after the three thanks. First apology to Ambassador Rizal Sukma, because you will probably find it difficult to challenge my findings later because there's a question mark, and I actually don't mean it that way. It's a typical case of attention seeking. You come up with a catchy headline and then you say, well, it's not so bad after all. I actually believe, and this is one of the arguments I'm going to propose in my short presentation, that the ASEAN political security community is actually the most important pillar of the community. But I'm going to explain, of course, why I think that it's justified to ask that question, right? Because it has to do with perceptions. Second apology to Jürgen, because I'm probably addressing his four questions only at the margins. What I'm trying to achieve this morning is to broaden the perspective on ASEAN a bit, because I believe that the mainstream academic preoccupation with ASEAN has too narrowly focused on high politics, on diplomacy, on great power relations, on order building based on, well, official diplomacy, meetings, international organizations, and so on. And I strongly believe there is more to ASEAN than this diplomatic level. Of course, everyone who works on ASEAN knows this very well. There is a growing involvement of civil society. ASEAN has moved beyond the elites, and most of the people who will speak today have been working on ASEAN for many times. Many of us are more or less the same generation as ASEAN itself. So we have grown up academically with ASEAN, and we have seen ASEAN grow, and we have seen all the changes. But still, I think there is the necessity really to also to broaden the empirical base in the study of ASEAN a bit. This is a bit cryptic at the moment, I know, but I will very soon clarify of what I mean by that. Okay, so why could anyone think that the ASEAN political security community is just a sideshow? Where do I have to point this to? Ah, here. Okay. I think we have to differentiate between the perception of ASEAN within the region, of course, but then also and the international perception of ASEAN. And I think what we have, the situation we have at the moment, is the perception of ASEAN as a three-issue organization. These are the three things that ASEAN is currently, I think, best known for. We have already noticed in the previous session that a lot of the interest is geared towards the South China Sea disputes. And in a way, although it's a complicated matter, it's a very complex dispute. I'm not going to talk about this now because we will cover this issue, of course, later. But it has put ASEAN on the map even more prominently than ASEAN was on the map already before. So it has fostered integration to the extent that it has brought the countries closer together because they are forced to deal with this issue. But when you look at the headlines here in Europe and also in the US and in many other places, what you read about ASEAN these days is very often related to the South China Sea disputes. And this is also very close to the second part of this perception of ASEAN, which is ASEAN as an international player. And in this regard, and Ambassador Rizal has already mentioned that and hinted at that in several of his comments, this has made ASEAN really successful, this ability of speaking with one voice on the international stage. And I think even at times that ASEAN is more successful than the EU in harmonizing and coordinating their foreign policy perspectives and interests and strategies. And this is what ASEAN has been very good at since the very early days of Southeast Asian regionalism, getting the great powers' attention, engaging the great powers in meaningful discussions and negotiations, having regular meetings, of course, for the smaller ASEAN member states, probably even for the bigger ones, it would not be possible to have these regular interaction with the great powers and many of the leading medium powers in the world without the umbrella of ASEAN. And then, of course, the third part here, regional economic integration. A lot of the international attention has focused on the so-called single market, which does not exist in reality, but regional economic integration has been steadily moving forward and is, in my view, also more successful than it is often presented, but that's an issue for a different day. So this is why I'm asking this question. Is it just a sideshow? Because you don't really hear a lot about that in the public discourses on ASEAN these days. In a way, it seems like that regional security, a peaceful and stable order is already taken for granted. That's a bit like democracy. In the beginning, when a country democratizes, when you're in a transitional process, you have a lot of engagement on the part of many various stakeholder groups. You have almost 100% of the people voting and so on. Once a democracy is established and is consolidated, interest is not as strong anymore and you take everything for granted, right? And I think that somehow also applies to us. We take it now for granted that Southeast Asia is one of the most stable and peaceful regions in the world. And there is, again, a strange discrepancy between the academic analysis, which focus very much on the security community and the fact that Southeast Asia is stable and peaceful and tries to find explanations why this is the case, and the more broader public perception, which is not very much interested in this issue, as it seems. So when we look at the ASEAN community, of course, we always find these three pillars. And again, I would say that the ASEAN political security here gets a lot less attention than the ASEAN economic community. This is also related to benchmarks, because economic cooperation is something that you can measure. You can measure the progress. There is either a single market or there is not a single market. There is either free movement of goods and services or there is not. There is either free movement of people or there is not. Right? It's very clear cut. Right? You have data for that. You have your indicators. And you can actually see to what extent regional economic integration has deepened. It's much more difficult for everything related to political and security-related cooperation, because when you look at the political security community blueprint and the objective that it has of strengthening democracy, enhancing good governance and the rule of law, and to promote and protect human rights, among other things, that's by definition always a process. You don't have clear benchmarks where you can say, well, now you have reached the level of universal acceptance of human rights and in every country a high standard of human rights is adhered to. And also ASEAN itself, since the economic political security community blueprint was made public, has not been very specific, right? Because what has always been stressed since then and repeatedly is that the security, the political security, deals with political development, shaping and sharing of norms, conflict prevention, conflict resolution, post-conflict peace building, and implementing mechanisms. And among the about 360 agreements and treaties that ASEAN has agreed on, many deal with the aspects that fall under the political and security community. And this is what the skeptics say then. Again, coming back to the issue, is it just a sideshow? When you look at these agreements, I've only put the most important ones on here, you always find people who say, well, okay, look at all that. But has anything been really implemented? What is the value of all these agreements when they are non-binding, when there is just voluntary implementation which is required? You don't have to do anything. You're not obliged to comply with what you have agreed. So what is the actual value? And then, of course, that's why I've used this cartoon, which is not really new, because it was actually referring to the situation in Myanmar a few years ago. That's why you see the grumpy Burmese general sitting there in the last carriage. So, but I mean, you can use it for many purposes when you talk about ASEAN, because this turning in circle arguments is made very often. And when you look at the Nafidor Declaration on the ASEAN Community's post-2015 vision, which basically develops the next steps of ASEAN cooperation and integration for the coming 10 years, you find, again, very general statements related to any aspects related to the political and security community. As it says, well, the objective is to promote the primacy of diplomacy and the peaceful settlement of disputes, adopt peaceful international and regional dispute settlement mechanisms, to address differences and disputes in the region and beyond, and so on. Well, this is why you, right, this generates, in a way, the perception that, yeah, okay, there is a general commitment to peace and stability, but so what? Every government in the world basically says that. And then to have the last critical slide here, before I spend the last 5 minutes telling you why I don't think it's a sideshow. One of the popular arguments you hear is then also, well, actually ASEAN has put in place a very elaborated institutional mechanism to deal with conflict management and conflict resolution. The High Council that actually has the formal power to resolve regional conflicts were already established in 1976. You have the dispute settlement mechanism, also a highly institutionalized formal approach to conflict management, established in 1996, followed by an even better and more elaborated system, which is the enhanced dispute settlement mechanism of 2004. Yet none of these mechanisms, let alone the High Council, has ever been employed. In the case of conflicts and disputes, you have the most prominent, the four that are always being quoted in this context, here on the other half of the slide. International bodies, international courts have been called to find a solution, and they have done so successfully. Not going into the details here, just to make the point. So then, when you look at the mainstream wave in the analysis of ASEAN, the social constructivist school, and if you confront social constructivists with these critical arguments of non-binding agreements that are not implemented and so on, they say, well, it doesn't matter. It's not a problem. And ASEAN, of course, as an organization, as a collective actor, that's why I put it in quotation marks, because that's another story. What actually is ASEAN? Who acts on the part of ASEAN agrees to that view. So you have this very interesting convergence between academic views on ASEAN and the official political views. And it seems that the two perspectives mutually reinforce each other. So the social constructivist, the mainstream in the ASEAN academic literature says, well, we don't need binding agreements. We don't need formal treaties like the EU, for example. We have shared norms and values, and based on these norms and values, there's a common identity, and this common identity leads to regional integration, the security community, and the security community is, of course, not defined as a military or defense alliance, but a community of states in which the use of military force can be largely ruled out as a means of problem solving, and this, of course, leads to peace and stability. The problem with that is it's not the fact that there are shared norms and values. I strongly believe there are, and they are emerging, and there is an emerging identity in ASEAN and Southeast Asia. For me, the question still is, how do these norms and values come about? How do they travel from one country to the other, or even from the so-called West to Southeast Asia? There's, of course, the argument proposed by Amitav Acharya, who says, well, many of these norms are derived from Western norms, universal global norms, and they are localized in Southeast Asia. I think this is only part of the story, and I'm going to give you two very short, very brief examples of that based on my current research that I'm also working on at here at the Southeast Asia Center at the moment. The first thing is when you look at human rights. The Human Rights Declaration was unveiled in 2012, heavily criticized by many, praised by others, saying, and I would see myself as being part of the group who says it's very important to have a human rights declaration. It's very important to have that discourse, even though the human rights declaration probably did not meet the expectations of every single stakeholder in Southeast Asia. But you have a human rights body based on that, so there is an increasing sensitivity for issues of human rights. And when you then look at individual member states, for example, Vietnam. Vietnam amended its constitution, put in a few more paragraphs that deal with human rights. Again, some say it's not going far enough. Yes, I will do. Yes, thank you. I was expecting that for some time, but anyway. So again, but it's important. I recently did research in Vietnam on that, and I spoke to many of the stakeholders involved who were involved in drafting these new paragraphs for the Constitution. I said, okay, it's not going far enough. It's not actually entirely what we proposed to the Vietnamese government, but it's important to have this discourse because 10 years ago, you couldn't talk about human rights in Vietnam. Now you have a public discourse on human rights in Vietnam, and this is very important. And this is partly, at least, due to the fact, and I would say even mainly due to the fact, that ASEAN has set a framework for these discussions to take place. Because there is growing peer pressure on countries to take more actions concerning adherence to human rights or protecting human rights. And related to that is the fact that you have at several leading universities here. I have pictures of the law university in Ho Chi Minh City in Vietnam, which have now extensive degree programs in human rights. There are several thousand students already at postgraduate level in Vietnam who have wrote their thesis and dissertations on human rights issues. And also very importantly, again, in the case of the Ho Chi Minh Law University, due to the framework that ASEAN has put in place, this university now cooperates very closely with other universities from the region on exchanges on human rights, on promoting courses related to human rights, particularly with universities in Thailand. Well, you might say, well, this is not official ASEAN diplomacy. This is not directly related to establishing a political and security community. But these are the clear effects of ASEAN initiatives towards promoting democracy, rule of law, and human rights. The other aspect here is that, and this brings me to my last question, that a lot of this is donor-driven, driven by external actors, which begs the question of actually who owns regional integration in Southeast Asia. Because in the case of Vietnam and human rights and the universities, these programs were established with the financial support of Denmark and Sweden, and partly also the EU. Sweden has phased out of Vietnam, and so has Denmark. So it's unclear what the future of these programs will be, but I think they are sustainable. And I don't have time for the... Okay, but this is also very important because also these donor initiatives, this external support to ASEAN in the case of human rights is aligned with the overall ASEAN strategies and policies. So you have a lot of buy-in on the part of the external stakeholders. The second case, which I cannot elaborate on in detail, is the way that Thailand has become a donor and actively promotes and supports all sorts of development-related projects in other Southeast Asian countries, two of the arrows there. And, of course, narrowing the development gap is a very crucial element of building and sustaining peace and stability in the region, as we also know from the European example. And although many say, well, ASEAN hasn't done a lot to narrow this gap, although it's the official policy, you see in these cases that it actually happens. It might not be directly related to official ASEAN meetings and so on, but it is initiatives that countries have developed within the context of ASEAN that has been agreed on. And finally, these are the donors, the external stakeholders I'm aware of that support ASEAN's efforts in deepening the political security community. We are talking about several thousands of individual projects in support of the ASEAN community. And to conclude, I have to do a bit more research on that, and I know that some research has also been done on this issue. But for me, the important question here is, who drives these agendas? So you can see that donors align their support with official ASEAN policies, but they also bring in their own ideas, their own expertise. So this creates a new dimension in the study of how norms travel. So conclusions here, the APSC is not a sideshow but the main pillar of the ASEAN community. Security and order building on the basis of shared norms and identities takes place, but the idea that this is mainly an endogenous process with some norms diffusion going on, I think is misleading. It's much broader than that, and when you look at all the donor support, the involvement of external actors, you find that ASEAN integration is actually very much driven by a rather successful approach to North-South-South cooperation. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Thank you, Jörn. We'll move straight on to the next presentation.
Oh. Yes. Sabotaged. Yes. Thank you. Excellencies and less than excellencies. Everybody else, hello. Two thank yous to the centre. Firstly, thank you for inviting me, but also thank you for existing. I hope that everything you do reverses the rather sad decline of Southeast Asian studies in the UK recently, and anything we can all do together to re-establish Southeast Asia as a place which is different from East Asia and South Asia, the better, I think. So this is great. Please keep up the great work. I do need to say that since I've been introduced as partly belonging to the BBC, I'm not working for the BBC today. This is not their point of view. This is mine. Whenever China does something in the South China Sea that Western commentators, security commentators mainly, don't like, we usually hear calls for ASEAN to do something. Exactly what ASEAN should do is rarely mentioned, but there's an assumption in these writings that if only that thing could be done, then the situation would improve. In the end, ASEAN usually issues another piece of paper, and the analysts throw up their hands in frustration. ASEAN is denounced as a pointless talking shop, but is that fair? ASEAN's problem here, I think, is a mismatch of expectations. Even if we say we don't, most outside observers regard Southeast Asia as a natural region, a region whose boundaries have now become instantiated in the external frontiers of ASEAN itself. And from this outlook, we expect this region to have a natural cohesion and, more importantly, a natural solidarity on regional questions. This sets up expectations about how ASEAN should behave and inevitably leads to the organisation being judged against an unfair yardstick and falling short. Interesting, when I found this graphic on the internet, Hainan Island was coloured in as being part of Southeast Asia. I had to edit the thing. So there are different ideas about where Southeast Asia begins and ends. In the words of the veteran Singaporean diplomat, Bilahari Kausikan, too often ASEAN is accused, too often commentators accuse a cow of being an imperfect horse. The disappointing news for regionalists is that even after nearly 50 years of existence, theirs is still very much a minority view within ASEAN. There's very little willingness to make compromises of national interest for the regional good or to make short-term sacrifices for long-term benefits. Different countries have different assessments of the situation in the South China Sea and differing appreciations of the benefits and costs of a rising China. Too often, I think, outside observers assume that Southeast Asian governments share their view of China as a threat, both to the independence of governments in the region and to the overall rules-based order. Moreover, they assume that the states could share a collective view on this and act accordingly. One can make the case that the current Philippine government might share this assessment of China, but how many others agree? Even in Vietnam, also locked in struggle with China over the South China Sea, has a more complex relationship with China, as the recent leadership battle there demonstrated. There are plenty of benefits that can flow from a good relationship with China: trade, aid, investment, and political support. In 2013, ASEAN countries exported $200 billion worth of goods and services to China, although only Malaysia and Thailand managed to have a trade surplus. According to the ADB, countries of East and Southeast Asia need to spend $5.5 trillion between 2010 and 2020 to upgrade their infrastructure to modern standards. With China offering bilateral aid through its Belt and Road strategy and via the Asian Infrastructure Investment Bank, there are good reasons to keep cozy with Beijing. And political support may be just as important. Vietnam may have differences with China over the South China Sea and other issues, but Vietnam's ruling Communist Party knows that its big brother in Beijing would much prefer to see the Communist Party in power there than replaced by something more capitalist. If there were ever a threat to the Hanoi regime, it could expect substantial support from over the border. I imagine the same thing would be true of Laos. China's rise has also given an alternative option to countries that may have formerly been subject to US pressure over good governance and human rights. Cambodia has become expert against playing off the US and China against each other, gaining aid and investment and fending off calls for further democratization. For almost 25 years after the end of the Cold War, the US was the dominant political force in Southeast Asia. In 2006, it could pressure the Thai military to hand back power to civilians about a year later. But since the last coup, it's been unable to pressure the military effectively, largely because of the fear that they might turn to China. In Malaysia, too, the rise of China is helping the government out of the hole it has managed to dig for itself. After talks between Prime Minister Najib and his Chinese counterpart Li Keqiang last November, a Chinese state-owned company bailed out the massively indebted 1MDB sovereign investment fund. As the government in Malaysia cracks down on free expression and corruption investigators die mysterious deaths, Washington stays largely silent. It wants Malaysia inside the Trans-Pacific Partnership and knows that Beijing has fewer qualms about dealing with unpleasant regimes. The risk, of course, is that great power competition will cause rifts within Southeast Asian elites. Ambassador Sukma spoke about rifts within Southeast Asia, but I think rifts within individual Southeast Asian countries is also just as much a risk, such as when different parts of the Indonesian government back rival Chinese and Japanese high-speed rail projects. We should be seriously concerned about whether these tendencies will force tendencies towards greater corruption, splits, and factionalism within these societies as the pressures increase. Nonetheless, ASEAN has found a need to have a collective view on issues relating to the South China Sea and managed to maintain some kind of consensus despite pressures not to. To some extent, it's possible to argue that ASEAN states have been able to constrain China. I'll go back and talk about how ASEAN took a view on the South China Sea. It begins, ASEAN's involvement with the South China Sea has always been a reaction to advances by China. It began informally in the aftermath of China's 1988 occupation of six features in the Spratly Islands. With the backing of their governments, the Indonesian diplomat Hasim Jalal and the Canadian academic Ian Townsend-Galt toured ASEAN capitals canvassing ideas for confidence-building discussions. With the support of their government again, they then organised the first gathering in January 1990. Although this was explicitly not an ASEAN activity, the discussions at these workshops did lead to the adoption of ASEAN's first collective comment on the South China Sea, the Manila Declaration of 1992. Now, the declaration was a response to a new law on the territorial sea announced by the Chinese government a few months beforehand. And under that law, China granted an American company, Crestone, rights to explore for oil off the Vietnamese coast in an area immediately adjacent to waters claimed by Indonesia and Malaysia. So although, as you see, as the ambassador said, the nine dotted line is an imaginary line, well, for some people, this has real force. You can see how the Americans drew their oil concession precisely to only annoy the Vietnamese while being as close as possible to the Indonesian and Malaysian lines and within China's U-shaped line claim. Although Vietnam was still regarded with suspicion by its neighbours at this point, it was still under sanctions, the episode alarmed the then six ASEAN states sufficiently for them to unite for the first time over this issue. Now, the Manila Declaration urged all parties concerned to exercise restraint with the view to creating a positive climate for the eventual resolution of disputes, and then called for all parties concerned to apply the principles contained in the Treaty of Amity and Cooperation to establish a code of international conduct over the South China Sea. Fine words. But it then took 10 years to hammer out not a code of conduct, but a more vague declaration on the conduct of parties. It was formally agreed with China in November 2002. It then took a further 9 years until July 2011 for ASEAN states and China to agree, again, not a code of conduct, but guidelines for the implementation of the DOC. July the 22nd will be the 24th anniversary of the original Manila Declaration, and there's still no sign of a code of conduct. The ASEAN-China Joint Working Group on the Implementation of the DOC, the ACJWG, continues to meet, but the two sides have not been able to find agreement on concrete measures to control activities in the South China Sea. In short, China isn't going to agree to anything that limits its freedom of action, and there's no point ASEAN agreeing to anything that doesn't limit China's freedom of action. So there are three possible outcomes to the ongoing talks. Either they collapse, they result in another pointless piece of paper, or they go on forever, providing much-needed state subsidies to the luxury hotels of Southeast Asia. The best that can be said for the process is, to quote Winston Churchill, "Jaw-jaw is better than war-war." Now, the Philippines has frustrated its ASEAN colleagues by demanding solidarity at some points and then acting utterly without consultation at others. That was the case when, 2 years after agreeing the Declaration on the Conduct of Parties, the government of Gloria Arroyo agreed the joint marine seismic undertaking with Beijing in September 2004. The Vietnamese were livid and forced their way into the agreement a few months later. The deal gave the three countries insight into the likely location of hydrocarbons in the disputed areas, but fell apart within 4 years under a torrent of corruption allegations in the Philippines. Manila then went back to collective action by approving the DOC guidelines. In May 2011, the Philippines Department of Foreign Affairs then tried to persuade its ASEAN partners to back a plan for a zone of peace, freedom, friendship, and cooperation in the sea. It was, in fact, a clever plan, trying to turn the process for resolving the disputes on its head by firstly agreeing areas that weren't disputed and then concentrating on the rest. However, the Philippines Department of Foreign Affairs pursued the diplomacy at a pace that was unrealistically swift and without the necessary preparatory work, and their ASEAN counterparts chose not to support it. Then, in January 2013, Manila went unilateral again and initiated legal proceedings against Beijing at the Permanent Court of Arbitration in The Hague. If successful, and we should hear this within weeks, the case will, in effect, give international legal backing for the original ZOPFFC proposal. Note that it was only after the Philippines filed the case at a meeting in September 2013 that China agreed to hold the first serious talks about the details of the code of conduct. Perhaps this time the COC could make some progress. However, in mid-2014, the Chinese government marshalled one state-owned oil company, the subsidiary of another, the Coast Guard, the Navy, and the Maritime Militia, and tried to drill for oil in waters west of the Paracel Islands, also claimed by Vietnam. The expedition began just a week before an ASEAN summit. Perhaps Beijing was hoping to split ASEAN again, as it had done successfully in 2012 at the foreign ministers' meeting in Phnom Penh. If so, it failed completely. In fact, ASEAN took a step forward, taking a stance on the Paracels question, a purely bilateral dispute between China and Vietnam, for the first time. Just a piece of paper, but China ended the drilling expedition a month early and retreated to lick its wounds. It has not drilled for oil in disputed waters since. In the aftermath of the oil rig confrontation, China proposed making 2015 the year of China-ASEAN maritime cooperation. The year was formally launched on the sidelines of the Bar Forum, but was met with a deafening silence. Its failure followed that of the China-ASEAN Maritime Cooperation Fund, announced with much fanfare at the 14th China-ASEAN Summit in 2011. Its $500 million budget doesn't appear to have disbursed any funds outside China, as far as I know. The China-ASEAN Maritime Partnership was proposed by Wen Jiabao at the 15th Summit in 2012. Again, so far as I know, nothing has come of it. ASEAN has declined to participate. There is no cooperation. This is how ASEAN resists, not with gunboats, but by not issuing pieces of paper. China's actions have caused even Malaysia to adjust its previous attitude of keep quiet and trust in the special relationship. Prime Minister Najib personally criticised China's island building in the run-up to the ASEAN summit in April last year. Despite early indications that Malaysia would try to steer ASEAN away from confrontation with China, under its chairmanship, ASEAN was resolute in its opposition to China's recent actions. The summit conclusions were forthright, noting that China's island building had eroded trust and confidence and may undermine peace, security, and stability in the South China Sea. My sources also suggest that Malaysian officials have been working more closely with their counterparts from Vietnam and the Philippines, both in developing common positions on the sea disputes and as a trio vis-à-vis China. Now, ASEAN isn't a military alliance, but it doesn't prevent individual members from forming their own security arrangements. All around the region, the old hub-and-spoke pattern, with the US as the hub, is being matched by new peer-to-peer networks. Countries concerned about the South China Sea are gradually building new, direct security and diplomatic relations with each other. In November 2015, the Philippines and Vietnam signed a strategic partnership building on previous military contacts. The Philippines and Japan held their first ever joint naval exercises in the South China Sea in May 2015. Japan has also formed strategic partnerships with Vietnam, Indonesia, and Malaysia. Singapore has just concluded a new strategic partnership with Australia. They may not say so publicly, but privately, the Southeast Asian claimants have, in essence, reached a common position on the resolution of the territorial disputes. They point to the language in the 2002 DOC about not resorting to the threat or use of force to demonstrate that they have no plans to expel other Southeast Asian claimants from the features that they occupy. In other words, de facto, they respect the legitimacy of the existing island and reef occupations. They may not yet be prepared to give formal de jure recognition of these occupations, but it's clear that within ASEAN at least, territorial disputes in the Spratlys are barely an issue. Could the same de facto understanding be extended to China? ASEAN faces a powerful country with a revanchist agenda to enforce a territorial claim that it invented in the 1930s. We've heard that story before in Europe, and it didn't end well. In the face of this, I would argue that ASEAN has been relatively successful. It's largely maintained unity despite frequent and ongoing attempts by Beijing to divide it. Just this past April, the Chinese government attempted to strong-arm Brunei, Cambodia, and Laos into supporting its policy on the South China Sea with a one-sided public statement. However, Cambodia and Laos both denied making any new agreement, and Brunei was as silent as ever. In February, ASEAN, for the first time ever, gave support to legal moves to resolve the South China Sea disputes, in effect backing the Philippines' case against China. It's worth remembering that China hasn't occupied any new features in the South China Sea since Mischief Reef 22 years ago. China was forced to abandon the oil rig expedition in 2014 and has failed to make headway with its own version of maritime cooperation. The situation may be bad, but it could have been worse. Being good on paper can be useful. China's view of a Sino-centric regional order is implicit in its talk of a new model of great power relations, and explicit when Chinese commentators talk about the Pacific being big enough for two to share. So we seem to be faced with three possible futures. In one, the great powers agree an Asian Yalta, dividing up the region into spheres of influence. In the second, there is a war. Both are deeply unattractive to all Southeast Asian governments. The third is a strategy of resistance and challenge to China's moves towards regional dominance, and that implies a long period of struggle and instability. There will be opportunities, but there will also be risks, and it won't be pretty.
Thank you, Bill. That was great.
Thank you very much, Excellencies, Professor Saul, distinguished participants. I have just 15 minutes, so I want to be very brief, but I want to do a little preface. It's good to be here at LSE. I've been invited here before, Rizal, so I don't need to be ambassador. Michael Leifer has had such a latent impact, I think, on the minds of many people who have come out of LSE and in the region all over the world. So it's nice to have a little reunion. I have to say, I want to thank Danny for inviting me here. I've not seen so much of Lincoln's Inn Fields before. I was here for 5 years, but didn't spend that much time around here. So it's good to see the LSE has expanded. I want to say that Southeast Asia is important for Britain because you have Brexit coming up. I think that Britain will survive either way. But Southeast Asia is a region of 635 million people, 2.5 trillion GDP, and the average growth trajectory for the region is 5.8 for the next 5 years and beyond. So it's the most dynamic, fastest growing region in the world. For the British to be thinking of leaving the EU, I think that they would have to think about where they would go thereafter if they do leave. And I think that Southeast Asia should not be having to compete so much for attention because it's just beckoning. I have, PowerPoints can be a time trap. So I have just three slides of maps, just so that we know what we're talking about a little bit, and I'll try to stay within time. And just a few takeaways. First, ASEAN and Southeast Asia are used often interchangeably, but in fact they are distinctive. They have been convergent. They have converged in the past as a region and organization. But I think in the future, they will become more divergent. There will be a region, yes, Southeast Asia. And the priorities of the Southeast Asian states, countries, will be different than the concerns, the objectives of the regional organization that we know as ASEAN. So that's one kind of takeaway. Second, I would say at the outset that Southeast Asia will likely see more tension and differences, perhaps leading to some turmoil and potential conflict in the years to come. Now, the time frame, we can discuss that towards the end. It depends how long it takes, but the trend is not optimistic. It's rather alarming and portentous. You know, I've been looking at Southeast Asia, ASEAN, right, since mid-1980s. In the last 18 months alone, there have been changes in this region, especially in the South China Sea, more than we've seen in the previous decades. It's astounding. It's astounding. I think the status quo has completely changed, and it's the ongoing changes are going to challenge ASEAN's raison d'etre. It's got to a point that you know, now you have to keep rationalizing, justifying why we need ASEAN. So it's got to a point that, you know, the final answer is that imagine Southeast Asia without ASEAN, what it would be like. It's not pretty. It's got to that point because a lot of criticisms now, a lot of concerns. I mean, there's even mockery of ASEAN. So going forward, there will be two theaters of tensions, geopolitical tensions. And you can see from this map, it's a very generic Southeast Asia map. It's an unnatural region. You know, we've heard two presentations, right? First, is it good on paper only? Of course, it's good on paper. And what was the other one that, you know, I think the title?
Sideshow?
It's both a sideshow. It's a sideshow, and it's only good on paper. I think that you don't really need the question marks after the presentations. But you can see from the map that it's an unnatural region. It's an unnatural region. People forget that it started out with just four countries. And Brunei was added on in 1984, and it expanded in the 1990s. But if you look at it, it's divided by the sea. It's divided by the sea. It's got different religions. Largest Muslim country, third largest democracy, Indonesia. A very large Catholic country, Philippines, and the largest Theravada Buddhist region in Myanmar, Laos, Cambodia, Thailand. So it's a very disparate, dichotomous, if you will, region separated by the sea. So one area of tension will be the maritime. And we can see that there's been no progress on the code of conduct. The DOC is still being talked about, but and I don't think China will have any conclusion. They will not agree to it. So South China Sea, there are many maps, but this is another generic one. The Spratlys are contested. I think the number one, the foremost security concern and threat to the region now is the artificial islands that China is building. The land reclamation has changed the reality on the ground. It's changed the status quo, and they're ramping up ahead of the tribunal decision, probably next month or thereafter, shortly thereafter. So it's very clear that China will play by its own rules. It's not going to play by the UNCLOS. And in fact, you know, it's an UNCLOS signatory. The U.S. has not ratified, but the U.S. action and behavior in the South China Sea has been more UNCLOS consistent than the Chinese. So South China Sea is full of tensions. I think that it will only get worse. And we get into a kind of a security dilemma, self-propelling logic. The more China does it, the more the others will have to react, and the more the other major powers outside will become more engaged. So that's one area I think that we will see more tensions in Southeast Asia. The other theater of geopolitical tensions that has not been mentioned is along the what I call the Mekong mainland, or mainland Southeast Asia, around the Mekong region. So you have a situation where, on the one hand, in the sea, you know, this China is building land in the sea, right? Building land in the sea. In the Mekong mainland, they're hogging water on the land. So, you know, taking the water on the land, having land in the sea. And this has really changed the outlook for the region. I know that Ambassador Rizal also knows we have a lot of uneasiness. And you have different views. In the Mekong mainland, I've just had a workshop organized called the Lan Chang Mekong Corporation, LMC. The LMC is China's new vehicle for managing Mekong tensions. In the Mekong mainland, there are no other major powers, only China and the smaller ASEAN states. Myanmar, Thailand, Laos, Cambodia, Vietnam. Obviously, the upstream dams in China are taking away water from the downstream countries, especially Cambodia and Vietnam. Laos and Thailand not complaining too much because Laos also dams. Laos has a number of dams, including, in particular, the Sayaburi Dam. And a lot of the Laos dams are financed by Thailand, and the hydropower that comes from the dams in Laos is sold to Thailand. So Thailand not complaining, Laos not complaining, is the lowest downstream countries, Cambodia and Vietnam. This year we have one of the worst droughts in decades. And you can see in Vietnam, you know, in this workshop, think tank workshop, the Vietnamese, Cambodians, very angry. But officially they don't say very much because they're beholden to China and China knows it. There is a Mekong River Commission that tries to provide a framework for managing water tensions, water conflicts up and down the river, but it has been superseded now by China's inaugural Lanchang Mekong Summit. And the Chinese have been consistent. They have shown that they will only play by the rules if it's their rules in the mainland. So, you know, it's going to be the Lanchang Mekong Summit. It's not going to be the Mekong River Commission. There will be no other vehicle, no other framework except the Chinese framework, and that's the LMC. In the South China Sea, I think that the COC is not going to be effective. I don't think it will be completed as many would hope. So these two theaters of conflict now, one in the on land, one in the sea, has increasingly dichotomized the region between mainland and maritime. And the mainland maritime interests are divergent increasingly. So you can see when mainland countries chair ASEAN, like Cambodia in 2012, Laos in 2016, you know, they're more sympathetic, supportive of the China position. And Myanmar doesn't have borders with South China Sea. So when it comes to the South China Sea, we in the mainland feel a bit distant. Don't relate to it as much. But of course, if you're sitting in one of the thousands of islands in Indonesia and Philippines, it's existential. It's clear and present danger. It's not that far away from where you sit. So for the maritime countries, when it comes to the Mekong, I noticed that it doesn't register as much. They don't relate to it. And for us, you know, we go around the mainland. When we go to the maritime, we have to fly. And thanks to the, you know, AirAsia and the low-cost airlines, we can now do that more than ever. But still, it's a big effort, So this kind of geography coming back to dictate directions is something that we haven't seen in the Cold War. I think it was subsumed under Cold War exigencies. Post-Cold War, we're seeing a broader unraveling of the region along these lines, mainland maritime. In the mainland, China's dominant. It's the backyard. They can do almost as they please. I mean, Vietnam has a lot of issues with China, but you notice that officially it's the Philippines who's at the forefront in taking China to task. The Vietnamese, they take a muted stance because they rely on China a lot. In the maritime, the U.S. is still preeminent. So if you look at the recent FON exercises, freedom of navigation, the U.S. maneuvers, stationing troops and military equipment in Philippines, not to mention already Australia, and this special kind of partnerships and allies that the U.S. has, formal allies in the Philippines, Thailand, strategic partnerships, sometimes called comprehensive, with Vietnam. Vietnam, you know, used to be the enemy, sworn enemy, right? Vietnam War. President Obama is going to visit Vietnam, Indonesia, Singapore, Malaysia. So the U.S. is very much still dominant in the sea theater, in the South China Sea. In the mainland, U.S. not there. They have this pivot rebalance, but it's lost credibility, it's lost thrust in view of the presidential contest and, you know, Mr. Trump's rise. And there's a lot of uncertainty. If Hillary Clinton wins somehow, then there will be continuity. People will feel very comfortable with that. She was one of the architects of the rebalance, the pivot. But if it's Donald Trump, then it's all question marks, and all bets are off to the U.S. position and pivot's rebalance strategy. In the mainland, the key relationship is China-Japan. It's not U.S.-China, it's China-Japan. And the Japanese, I hosted just a week ago, Foreign Minister Kumio Kishida. The Japanese, they feel like, you know, the Chinese have come in and to steal their thunder. I mean, they have built, they have invested, they have done a lot in mainland Southeast Asia. The Greater Mekong Subregion is a Japanese scheme, finance. They financed it. And the Greater Mekong Subregion now has been very successful. You can travel by roads from Myanmar to Vietnam, up and down, east, west. And the Japanese feel like in the last several years, the Chinese have really moved in. So they are stepping up their game. Now they're coming up with a new infrastructure aid package, several billion dollars. Minister Kishida made a big deal of it. So the Japanese are not going to forfeit mainland Southeast Asia, the Mekong mainland, to China. In the maritime, I think the U.S. will be working more with allies and like Japan and Philippines to kind of counter China's assertiveness. So you have these two theaters of tensions that I think will exacerbate. Now, how do we deal with that? This is where I worry. You know, when Rizal talked about post-ASEAN, and we have, you know, on paper, just a talk shop kind of arguments, it's a big concern. I think that going forward, ASEAN will see more divergences. You can see, and these divergences are, you know, it's very difficult to pinpoint because they're based on geography, based on very different interests. So for Laos and Cambodia, very much supportive of China. For Thailand, I raised the question on the domestic politics because since the last coup in May 2014, the military regime in Bangkok has gone head over heels for China's support and succor, and they have they've treated the Chinese officials, delegations in Bangkok, rolling out red carpet. So China has come into the Thailand picture much more, even though Thailand is a U.S. treaty ally. And then you see that the Philippines, just on the other end, very acerbic, visceral, confrontational vis-a-vis China. This is an ongoing trend that I think will intensify, and it will be compounded by the differences in the domestic regimes in the Philippines, Thailand, Indonesia, some democracies, some authoritarian regimes, and the lack of the camaraderie among the leaders. So the ASEAN thrust, you know, it feels to me it's not there. It's running on empty. The ASEAN community, the three pillars. You know, we're supposed to be in the middle of it now. This is 2016, but it doesn't feel at all like a community. ASEAN still trades more with outside markets, outside economies, China, you know, Japan, EU, and US, then inside. I think intra-ASEAN trade has gone up from my time studying it from 17 now to maybe closer to 30%, but still not high. Still not high. And the ASEAN trade, intra-ASEAN, is really among the original members, Malaysia, Thailand, Singapore, you know, Indonesia, Philippines. When you come to the new members, not that much. So a lot of challenges going forward. I'm not very optimistic. In addition, you know, ASEAN has been growing, expanding. Yeah, but going forward, despite a promising trajectory on average, they also need a new growth model. Cannot rely on export growth like before, foreign direct investment, export growth. It will have to be more consumption-based domestically, but also regionally. So, in fact, ASEAN needs ASEAN. The Southeast Asian economies need the AEC. They have a lot of incentive to make it work. But when you look at the geopolitical canvas, you're just seeing more and more tensions, more and more differences. We'll see this year how Laos will do. So far, so good. I've been told that the SOM meeting in Vientiane went very well. better than anticipated, but it's a big challenge for Laos. So overall, I think that we're looking at, we're going back to the beginnings. You know, when ASEAN was formed based on confrontation, keeping the major powers out, trying to have some strategic autonomy that Ambassador Rizal mentioned, promoting national development. Now the major powers are back in, and they're all over the place. And the ASEAN countries, especially the newer, the differences between mainland maritime, differences between newer and older members, are inviting, are providing an invitation for the major powers to have a greater role, the U.S. in the maritime, Japan in mainland, and with China as a kind of the established dominant power. So going forward, ASEAN will need to, and this is a cliche, but you know it's a true cliche, it has to get its act together. And I'm afraid that it is not going to. Now, yet it is not going to go away. It's not going to disappear. When you know, the ASEAN loves it when someone says that ASEAN is no good, then they close ranks, you know, and Rizal and I will be very defensive. But when things are going well or tracking along, ASEAN is very bureaucratic, very inert. Going forward, a lot of challenges. I think it will just be a matter of time. Next year, it's like this year. Year after, but 10 years from now, 20 years from now, ASEAN will be a lot less than it has been in the recent past. And it bodes ill for the region because of the challenges, insecurity that we will see. There will be no effective framework to manage it. It's a pessimistic outlook, but I think that we have to try to prevent it from happening and do what we can, but it doesn't look good. Yeah, and that should provide an impetus to do more. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Titinan. We will now move to Q&A, but before we get going, I'd like to call on Benjamin Ho, who has, we have an arrangement with as a sort of rapporteur. Benjamin is a PhD student in the International Relations Department, working on a China-related thesis, actually. And we're just calling me now to make some initial comments in relation to the presentations we've heard and to ask one or two questions, perhaps, that the panel then can take up. And after the panel has responded to those, we will give it out to the audience as a whole. I think we may have to cut 5 minutes of your next tea break because we are already overrunning slightly. I hope you don't mind. But we want to have a good Q&A session with an appropriate length to it. Benjamin, please.
Thanks, Jürgen. Thank you for the presentations. I thought they provided three very... wouldn't use the word disparate, but clearly very different feel at the end. And given that Tintinan gave us a very sobering assessment of ASEAN's futures, these are some things that we can think about. For the first two speakers, I think it's interesting that you guys highlighted that notwithstanding these problems, that whether ASEAN looks good on paper or whether it's just a sideshow, there are indeed promises and opportunities for ASEAN countries to work together. So it's not a zero-sum game. It's not the end of the world. Obviously, there are far more ways in which ASEAN countries can creatively manage some of their differences and actually find ways to cooperate. So I thank the three of you for providing a landscape and a spectrum of views, both optimistic, pessimistic, but I guess ultimately realistic appraisal of ASEAN. So for two questions, actually. My first question would be, I think given that in recent, I guess the past year, we have seen Chinese economy slowing down, and I think that has raised all sorts of other questions regarding China's relations with ASEAN, particularly countries like Laos, Cambodia, who are, to a large extent, are dependent on Chinese investments and involvement. So with that in mind, do you see ASEAN countries reassessing their obligations and views vis-a-vis China and to look for other ways whereby their interests can be protected? My second question is probably more of a comment, but I guess you guys can also take it on, which means this whole idea of ASEAN unity, centrality, solidarity. Many times we tend to think of these elements as ends rather than means, meaning that, I guess, for policymakers, we talk about ASEAN centrality, but a more really scholar would argue that these are merely instrumental means for countries to ultimately safeguard and preserve their own national interests. So in light of the fact that this might really be the case, and this is how policymakers may view it, so with how then do you see that, you see any tension between that view as ASEAN being instrumental and purely as a means? Would that run up against certain tensions in the coming years whereby the ASEAN community is viewed as an ends, whereby ASEAN centrality, unity need to be preserved, as what His Excellency Rizal Sukma mentioned? So just these two questions, and thank you.
Thank you, Benjamin. Should we start with you, Yuan?
Yes, is it already switched on here? Yes, so sounds good. Yes, perfect, perfect. Thank you very much. I would like to, I think, very, very relevant points you've raised here. As for China, I think it's exactly what I couldn't agree more with what Ambassador Sukma said, Rizal Sukma, that I mean, that is what ASEAN has been always been very good at, maneuvering the international space, right? And making sure that it is in as an organization, as a collective actor, it maintains good and beneficial cooperation with as many actors as possible on the international stage. And I think this continues. I mean, there is no one China basket, there is no one US basket or whatever. ASEAN has always very good at balancing that. And this is, I think, what makes ASEAN so successful as a regional organization. But this brings me to the second point of centrality. It is also, in a way, the point I wanted to make in my presentation, that I think the whole debate of whether or not there is ASEAN centrality is not relevant in the end, because it's a very successful myth that ASEAN has created for itself. That there is, ASEAN is a collective actor, that ASEAN speaks with one voice, that ASEAN is in charge of its own destiny, that ASEAN is the manager of international relations, or the architect and the manager of international relations in Southeast Asia, and so on. But in reality, we have very extensive networks that already exist. It's not ASEAN versus the rest, or ASEAN making strategic choices versus China and the US and the EU. It's all, in a way, negotiated. There are constant talks going on, constant ways and channels of interactions which are open. And what I was trying to show under the header of development cooperation in the broadest sense is that you have such a heavy involvement of external stakeholders in implementing the ASEAN community, all the three pillars, that you certainly have all these states I showed on the slide already in the region working very closely with ASEAN. And for me, the real problem is, and this is the challenge that ASEAN faces, I don't think that ASEAN really owns its own integration process to the full extent, because the commitment of the member states to contribute to the implementation of what they have actually agreed on is rather low, right? Because all the funding for implementation is basically provided by external actors, increasingly including China.
Thank you.
I've just had time to make some thoughts about the slowdown and the impact there. And I suppose the first question is the slowdown real? I mean, we know it's real in manufacturing and steel, but in the overall economy, the statistics aren't good enough to tell us whether China's economy as a whole is slow. I mean, services, cinema receipts, airlines, these things are still growing quite significantly. But in terms of manufacturing, which is what really affects Southeast Asia, I mean, in terms of, you know, the things that Southeast Asia has exported to China, you know, raw materials and so forth, yes, clearly there's a decline and a slump, and that's going to affect. Now, as China tries to unwind its overcapacity in steel and other industries, the incentive there will be to try to dump, and I mean that both technically and you know, kind of rhetorically, more and more excess production in Southeast Asia. High-speed rail links, whatever, you know, steel. You know, Southeast Asia is a market for China. It is it's its closest market. And so, therefore, the pressure to kind of to speed up exports and to subsidize and all the rest of it to kind of get to keep Chinese manufacturing jobs alive will probably become even stronger. Now, the trade balance, the overall trade balance between China and ASEAN is very much in favor of China at the moment, although most of that number is actually Vietnam has a huge trade deficit, $32 billion. And you can actually see a large, and I'm not exactly sure how much, but a very large proportion of that is simply a redirection of the China, of the US trade deficit with China, because this is stuff that's being exported for assembly in Vietnam and then being exported onto the US or Europe or Japan. I think Indonesia, there's a growing sense that it's feeling that it's lost out from the China-ASEAN free trade area. There's a sense that it hasn't been a mutually beneficial process. What will Southeast Asia export back to China to redress the trade balance? Is its future simply to be an expensive tourism destination so that Southeast Asian countries buy a lot of manufactured goods from China and then Chinese tourists come and spend the money in the hotels and that's how you balance it? Or is it going to have something, you know, a much more sophisticated economic strategy?
Well, there are two questions on the ASEAN. First, China slowdown. As far as we know, compared to the recent past, there is a slowdown. And a lot of distortions, especially in the SOEs. And so your question is, you know, what ASEAN is doing about it. In our program, first panel is ASEAN, second is Southeast Asia, third ASEAN, fourth Southeast Asia. So your question really has to do with, you know, how do the Southeast Asian economies adjust to the China slowdown in different ways. So I think in Vietnam, they've joined the TPP. You know, I think there's a coalition in Vietnam that wants to reform the economy using the TPP as an instrument. And then they want to also get away from China a bit. Malaysia also has joined TPP. Thailand doesn't have a forward-looking strategy. It's kind of stuck. So different economies are going different ways. They need the AEC, but it's not providing that growth potential that it should. There's a lot of infrastructure, public investment. So I think we will see different ways of coping with the China slowdown. On the ASEAN centrality, big topic, of course, is being overwhelmed. You know, we have a lot of acronyms and jargon, centrality, community, unity. There's another important one, the ASEAN way and so on. So centrality is compromised now, I think, certainly South China Sea since 2012, the lack of the joint statement. And then it's going to intensify. So ASEAN centrality, very problematic going forward.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, Tidina. All right, we're going to take questions now, perhaps starting with you, sir. Sort of just here.
It has been an interesting panel. And I just want to make a quick response, then maybe ask one question. For the questions which were touched upon in the development of the ASEAN, Southeast Asian, I believe that on the land, the speaker mentioned about the Mekong River development. I was personally involved in that for quite some time, and I believe that China's proposition for the Mekong River development has been warmly welcomed by the countries alongside. Even the dam projects, there are so many press reports about that, but it has been very useful in some of the time where we can adjust the water to benefit the harvest in the lower reaches. And as for the South China Sea, I believe that it has been widely discussed these days. We believe that this issue can and be a good place for cooperation rather than confrontation between the countries concerned. Especially we have been asking for the dialogue among the parties concerned directly and also called for the shelving of the disputes. So I'm not so pessimistic like you, and I believe that we talk about this global village and the partnerships. I believe we are neighbors with the countries concerned. We don't have to quarrel all the time. We should find some way. As for the question, I believe that these days people talk so much about the role of ASEAN, and many people, especially commentators, tend to think that the ASEAN should rely upon the United States militarily and rely on China commercially and economically. And I don't know whether you agree with these kind of arguments and what would be your comments.
Oh, can I ask you to go for that? Is that okay? So the question is really about whether ASEAN seems to side with the U.S. in terms of the military cooperation, but at the same time continues to rely on China economically. So in a way, it's about this hedging thing.
It's obviously good news if you're an American defense manufacturer, but bad news if you're an American civilian exporter. How long ago is it since the U.S. was the leading trading partner of ASEAN? I mean, 10 years, something like that? I mean, it's now in fourth place after combined EU, Japan, China. The U.S. is still a significant player, but it's a relatively diminished player in terms of trade. And, I mean, if the bargain is simply that the U.S. is going to spend billions, trillions, on maintaining security and isn't going to get any economic reward for that, then that's unsustainable in the long term. What always amazes me is that, in 2009, everything was going well for China in Southeast Asia. China just became Malaysia's largest trading partner. You had a very pro-China government in the Philippines under Arroyo. Vietnam and China had finished demarcating their land border. All was going pretty well. And China screwed it all up over one issue, the South China Sea. China has messed up all its regional diplomacy because of its insane, in my view, focus on this ridiculous territorial claim. If it could just forget about it and shut up about it, then the whole region would turn to China. The economic logic of trading with China was that Southeast Asia would become a market for Chinese products and a place for Chinese tourists and all the rest of it. But this one issue has just got in the way and given the United States a way back into the region. I just think it's the tail wagging the dog, really. And somebody in Beijing needs to kind of take this issue and tell a lot of people to shut up and think about what's really good for the state as a whole.
Thanks for the spirited response. We'll collect some questions now because of the time. Yes, at the very far back of the room, please.
My name's Tom Smith. I'm from the University of Portsmouth. I'd just like to respond to Bill, really, who commented about the Philippines. I don't know if we've got representatives from the Filipino government here today, but I feel like I should stand up for them a little bit.
You speak up a little bit. It's very difficult to hear.
Sorry, is that better? So it's the idea that the Philippines needs to be stood up for here and really in their independent actions and taking issues to UNCLOS and to the court hearing, which I think will actually be delayed for another month or two. So any imminent decisions is probably not going to come anytime soon. But for the Philippines, there are other issues which ASEAN could come to the rescue for other than the islands. This is particularly, I'm talking about the Abu Sayyaf, other security issues in the region, which other countries, Indonesia having fishermen released by the Abu Sayyaf just recently this week, Canadians being beheaded, Norwegians being held captive. This is a hot security topic which ASEAN could help with and is more or less silent on.
Okay, all right, thank you. Anyone else who wishes to answer a question? There was somebody in the middle of the room just now, but maybe that question has been withdrawn. All right. Maybe I can actually put this question to Titinam, but in the terms of whether or not you believe that ASEAN is likely to play a different role in future when it comes to dealing with domestic issues that have transnational spillover potentially.
As we know, the ASEAN mantra is the non-interference principle, right? The ASEAN way, non-interference. But in fact, ASEAN has been involved in each other's domestic affairs on certain occasions. The Nargis would come to mind, and even going back to the Cambodian peace settlement in the early 1990s. So ASEAN has played a role in other ASEAN countries. In the question you had about Philippines, for example, in southern Thailand, the Malay Muslim insurgency, Malaysia has been designated, agreed to be the facilitator for the peace talks, but the peace talks have not made much progress. We've had some settlements. Bang Samoro, I think the Malaysians played a critical role, instrumental role, in coming up with a framework. It's still very fragile, and perhaps it will not work, but it's getting there. Thailand is way behind, of course, but Indonesia, we saw some outside mediators, but ASEAN also had a role in combating terrorism. Jamaah Islamiyah, I think Indonesia has done a enormous job increasing the capacity, having a counterterrorism center even. So it can play a role, but it depends. ASEAN collectively can play a role in different Southeast Asian countries, but it depends on what's the problem. It depends on what the problems are.
Okay, thank you. We have another question again at the far end of the room, and then one sort of later on in the middle. So first of all, at the far end.
Hi, hello. I have a question about migration and how ASEAN or the states in Southeast Asia sort of come up with a regional framework. And I wonder whether you think that the response to the Rohingya crisis, for example, whether a regional approach through ASEAN is more likely or whether through multilateral discussions.
Thank you very much. And the lady in the middle of the room.
I think this question should have been asked to His Excellency, the
Can
Ambassador.
Can you speak up a little bit, please?
My question should have been asked to His Excellency, the Ambassador to the UK from Indonesia. So he emphasized the importance of maintaining ASEAN's regional mandate of order. And then Bill Hayton now just mentioned in his presentation that ASEAN does not prevent individual member states to embark on strategic partnerships and making cooperations with other member states, but also countries outside the ASEAN. And let me take an example with Vietnam. Not only has it improved bilateral cooperation with the Philippines, India, Russia, and the US, but also next week Obama is coming to visit to Vietnam, and there are now speculations that the U.S. is going to fully lift its weapon embargo on the country. And because individual countries like Vietnam now are increasingly embarking on bilateral strategic partnerships, do you think that that undermines ASEAN's regional mandate of securing order when it comes to the South China Sea dispute?
Thank you. Thank you. We would like to take up the question concerning the regional approach, possible regional approach to the Rohingya.
Can I briefly say something? Thank you. Well, I think you stressed a very important issue here, migration. I think this is it ranks high on the ASEAN agenda. You have lots of meetings on migration. Of course, we always have to distinguish between the official, formal, skilled labor migration, which is increasingly regulated, not implemented. We have mutual recognition agreements for highly skilled labor, and implementation is another issue. If you have to sit and pass an exam and demonstrate that you're fluent in Thai, in written and spoken Thai, for example, when you want to work as an accountant in Thailand, that begs a few questions if that is actually achievable. But anyway, I mean, there is a lot of emphasis on that within the context of the ASEAN economic community. What is lacking are workable solutions towards resolving unregulated migration. And the Rohingya crisis clearly pointed that out, that there is no framework in place. We know how difficult that is, looking at our situation here in Europe. But here is an area also where you don't have a very strong involvement of external actors trying to help and assist ASEAN in managing this. And at the moment, I don't really see any sustainable approaches, effective approaches towards addressing this issue. And again, it's also related to the other question about bilateralism. It is more the case of countries in their bilateral relations trying to negotiate legal frameworks for the protection of their workers. The Philippines has been quite successful at that, making sure that Filipinos working overseas are protected in Malaysia, for example. But that is not the case, as far as I know, for Indonesia and Malaysia. I mean, there are lots of problems in terms of bilateral relations when it comes to Indonesians working in Malaysia and so on. I mean, things have been moving forward when they have been dealt with and resolved bilaterally, but there is no effective multilateral framework yet.
Thank you. Titina?
Yeah, just 1 minute. So two questions. First is the Rohingyas. You know, this we call this the boat people crisis, irregular migration, and it's seasonal. Should be this is season now, but this year not so bad. This is a case where limited ASEAN cooperation only among certain members. It mainly is Indonesia, Malaysia, Thailand, and then Myanmar, involving Myanmar, and then Bangladesh is not in ASEAN, but Bangladesh is critical here. Most of the boat people are from Bangladesh, some from Rakhine State, Rohingyas, but last year they were pretty good at handling this issue. So this year, not so much a problem, but there's no long-term framework to deal with this. And you can imagine Vietnam, Philippines, they are distant, so they don't not so concerned about the boat people crisis. It's more the Andaman Sea, Indian Ocean, so that side. So it has to be an ASEAN plus, you know, a limited ASEAN plus kind of coordination handling. The question is very good about, you know, if ASEAN, I think someone over here, goes outside. So you look at ASEAN in, right? Inside ASEAN, what can they do together? Can they cooperate as an entity collectively in other ASEAN countries? Limited. It depends on the issues, the problems. And then increasingly, you see them going outside. You know, bilateral FTAs. TPP has four ASEAN economies. Geopolitical, U.S., China, Laos, Cambodia, U.S., Philippines, and so on. So this is a kind of a pooling forces that are going to challenge ASEAN even more going forward.
Okay, I think we've run out of time for this particular session. It would be impossible for me to try and summarize all of it, but I just want to make perhaps three points that I think it might be worth thinking about. So the panel was on security, obviously, and the role of ASEAN, and I think what came out of the presentations very clearly for me is that it's still, as always it has been, sufficient to think about political, military security when we talk ASEAN. Yeah? The comprehensive notion of security has been employed by the three presenters, and I think that's sort of is something that we should always be mindful of. Secondly, I think we've heard a lot about ASEAN implementing things, ASEAN member states implementing particular things at a bilateral basis or through sub-regional cooperation, relying on outsiders, the various major powers. And perhaps it would be appropriate, obviously, for the member states to think again as to what practical steps they can actually take in relation to some of the issues that were under discussion. That is to sort of make the move from the paper to actual implementation, which, of course, historically has also been reserved mostly at the national level rather than at the level of ASEAN itself. And perhaps the third point is some of this, particularly Yuan Josh's point about the regional integration process not owned by the ASEAN member states themselves, that makes me think at least about whether it is time again to open up the debate about what countries, if any, can perhaps leverage their resources and their influence within the association to make more of an impact for the good of all. And with that, I'd like to thank the panelists, and I hope you will join me sort of in doing that as this now draws to a close. Thank you very much.